All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 69 in this American History program of History at Our House for the Junior and Senior High. We are going to proceed into this story that I've been promising you of the transition from the American Republic to what I believe is the most correct characterization of America for quite some time now, and that is to a constitutional democracy. So today we're going to see a very interesting step in that direction. It's still, I would say, an indication. What we're going to see today, called the Missouri Compromise, is still a time in American history where I would call America a republic. And it comes during the presidency of James Monroe. But after this, we will start to see a definite transition. So keep that in mind as we're proceeding here. I want to challenge you guys in this particular regard with the terminology that I'm using. Republic, a government dedicated to the protection of individual rights. When do you get to use that term? For instance, why would you call Rome a republic at a certain point? Why was Athens a democracy? And how did America go from being one and change into the other? And what is the value of being able to name that and clearly grasp this change? I would contend that the value is very significant and has a huge impact on how you understand the world around you and how you should perceive the society you live in and look around at the world and see others as well and decide how you're going to live your life accordingly. I do think there are outcomes there. They are very adult outcomes, and so I'm not necessarily going to reveal to you what I think they all are. But, you know, we're on a path here to understanding the world, and you at the stage of life that you're in are on that path. And I'm just hoping to help render you intellectually independent so that when you face the world around you, you're equipped, you've got the right knowledge, you've got the means of understanding, and you can then pursue your happiness as well as can be. So let me share my screen, and we're going to start into this very interesting phase of American history leading up to what's called the Missouri Compromise. And the first thing that I want to do is I want to highlight the contradiction that was rooted in the American system, that became embedded in the American system of government, and which eventually undermined the republic to the extent that you could no longer call America a republic. So I think this is part of this transition that I'm talking to you about, and that I want you to try to grasp away from being a republic. It involves this contradiction. And so let's take a look at it. It goes like this. Okay, so let's start with that. I'd like somebody to read that to us here. I need a volunteer reader. And then we're going to kind of parse this out here and make sure that we grasp this logical progression and where it leads. So, number one, Alexander, only, please.
Rights require independence.
Okay, period. All right, so we have one. This is called, in logic, does anybody know what this is called? It's called a premise. This is a premise. Okay? Now we have one premise, and what do you make of this premise? Is it a true premise, you guys? Let's start with that. Is this a true premise? Rights require independence. And what I mean by that is, in the time, right? 1776, did rights require independence? If you can't raise your hand and ask that and answer that question, you don't deserve to live in the United States, quite frankly. So Let's see what you can come up with. Did rights require independence, or are the founding fathers deluded? We don't have a lot of confident voters here? Timothy?
I think the answer would be yes.
Why is it so tentative? Why is it so tentative? So you don't buy this whole thing of Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington? It's kind of like this sort of iffy kind of proposition for you, what they did? You're not necessarily sure they were right? Interesting. Bria?
No, you definitely have to have independence to have rights, because if you're not independent, then how are you... You don't even... It's like a slave having rights. You just can't. It doesn't work.
Yeah, okay, but you're being... That's kind of a philosophical way of looking at it, Bria. I'm asking you more of a historical question. Did it require independence at the time? Declan?
Well, what I'm thinking is that you don't have to have independence. Because, say, the king could have given them the rights.
Whoa! Oh, I'm glad you said that, because that's just... That's a scary statement right there, Declan. You gotta watch out on that one, because something given can be taken away. Rights are not a gift from the king, and your rights are not a gift from your government. Your rights, as the founding fathers so correctly understood, are inalienable to your person, because you are a human being. So don't ever fall into the trap of thinking that your rights are something given to you by somebody else. Because if that's the case, then they can just as easily be taken away. So no, I'm glad you said that, because that is such a common point of view, and it's a really terrible one, that rights are a gift from others. No way. And the founding fathers, I mean, that's why the founding fathers were so clear on this premise. Rights are natural. They are a part of your nature. And that's why rights require independence. You can't have it. Oh, I'm a little bit dismayed here. You could have rights in a constitutional monarchy? We gotta go and study British history more closely, perhaps. British history was nothing but a gigantic, centuries-long battle between the people in order to secure their rights against the king. It's inherently unstable. So, yeah, I'm glad you said it, but no, it's not true. Rights required independence. Bria.
I definitely agree with you, Mr. Powell, because in British history, they're literally fighting over almost everything.
Exactly, all the time. Exactly. You look at the whole of British history after the Magna Carta. You got the Parliament, and then you have Edward I's model Parliament, and then you have the deposition of Edward II, and then you have the Hundred Years' War, and then you have the kings in the time of the Reformation, and then you have the Civil War against Charles II, and then you have, oh my gosh, all of this. It's just nonstop war for rights. That's not rights. You gotta have a country that protects them. So the founders were crystal clear on this point, and they were right. I hope that resonates a little bit with you here. This idea that the king could have this benevolent emanation and say, yes, here are your rights, I grant them to you. Oh my gosh, don't think that for a second. That's not a right. Right is not a gift. So yes, rights required independence. All right, I want to be challenged on that. I want somebody to try to advocate for the opposite, or I want somebody to try to bash this down here, because I think the more we pay attention to this, the better. So I mostly got Bria on my side. Declan, did I just kind of force you to cower, or did I convince you?
Well, you've sort of convinced me.
Sort of. Okay, I like your honest answers, Declan. I like honest answers better than just, okay, Mr. Powell, he's just kind of the teacher and I won't convince... Yeah. Okay, sort of convince me. I see. All right, well, you're going to need a little bit of philosophy and politics to understand what rights are. Okay, so, and Alexander, you've been brainwashed adequately, is that right? Oh, okay, that's good to know. It's always nice when you raise your hand and let people know, too. Okay, so yeah, the founders, I mean, all right, we'll put it this way. The founders believed in inalienable individual rights, which means non-kingable rights, having nothing to do with the concept of a ruler, period. And they didn't see rights as a grant from some higher authority. They saw them as pertaining to human nature. So no, you can't have rights without independence. So that's premise one. Okay. Then premise two. Oh man, we had quite a bit of trouble with premise one, but what do you think? True or false? Independence requires union. This is more contentious. So I'm happy to have Declan take me on here. Bria, what do you think?
Definitely requires union, because if everybody's fighting against each other, then there's no reason for there to be independence.
Okay, so Bria is a Federalist. One of my favorite people in the history of the world, Patrick Henry, was an anti-Federalist, however. Timothy, what do you think?
I don't think independence does require... Because if people aren't united, and even if people are fighting against each other, they still have independence.
Well, see, that was what the Founding Fathers, again, would disagree with you historically. They looked at all the examples. For instance, they looked at Greece, which was unified against ancient Persia, and thereby was able to defeat Persia. And then once Greece became disunified, Sparta versus Athens and Thebes versus Sparta, then Greece was conquered by Macedonia. So the history there was quite clear. Germany, the Holy Roman Empire, was not united, and it was constantly being invaded and ruled by people of other countries and a failed state. Countries that were united, like France, were powerful and great. And empires like Rome were great to the extent that they were united. So the Founding Fathers, because they were so well-schooled in history, looked at all the cases and they said, you know what, right? Independence requires union. If you're not united, you're not going to be able to stand up in this world, because it's a messy and mean world. And France and all the other superpowers out there are not going to give up a care in the world for North Carolina versus Virginia. They're going to see that as a way to take an advantage, and they're going to come and they're going to insert themselves and take over our politics, and we won't be independent. So, Alexander, where do you stand?
I was pretty much going to say everything you just said. It doesn't exactly have to require it, but on the scale of countries in that time where you have all of these big globalized Frances and Spains and Britons, then yes, independence of America does require the unification of the United States.
That's very well put, Alexander. Right. In the context of globalization, in the context of European superpowers, it was necessary. Good. Well said. Bria.
Well, what I was going to say is very similar to Timothy, but with independence, you have to have lots of people to... Independence can be compromised. If there's lots of people against you, you need lots of people to go with you.
Okay. That's right. Okay. So, yeah, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more as well, this idea of kind of the union being compromised and the challenges involved there. All right. So I see we got some thoughtful folks here who are not always just toeing the line, which is really good. But so hopefully I've at least articulated to you the case that the founding fathers were making, right? So this was their thinking. This is necessary. On that, I personally agree 100%. This is necessary. On that, I agree about 90%. And so, therefore, I'm right there with them. Do you see how this, you know, premise one plus premise two leads to conclusion number one? Does anybody, okay, if we accept, let me put it to you this way. Cliff, if you accept premise one and premise two, is conclusion number one inevitable?
Yes,
it is. In logic, right? In logic, as Aristotle taught human beings to reason, if this is true and this is true, then this is true. And it's what we say, ineluctable. You cannot hold this and this and not hold this at the same time. So this is true. So now, operating from these first two premises and thus this first conclusion, now we head into very difficult territory. We get premise number three, Alexander.
Union requires slavery.
Okay, what do you make of that? Is that true?
Well, it depends on who's in the union.
Indeed. And if we're looking on the right-hand side and we see those dark pink states required in the union and they all have slavery, then is it true?
Well, if they don't want to join the union without slavery, then yes, but if they don't want to be conquered, then they better join the union anyway, whether...
Yeah, okay, right. So, yeah, all that adds up to, yes, union requires that the blue states and the pink states join, and therefore it requires accepting slavery as a part of the union. So this is also true. Here's where we go into this fascinating territory. If this is true, now you see what happens is we take conclusion one, okay, and then we take conclusion one becomes premise one. Rights require union. And then we take, you know, three here, which is the third one. Well, now it's more like just premise number two. Now we take these two premises. Rights require union, and union requires slavery, and we come to conclusion two. So, Keen, what do you make of this?
Rights require slavery. I think that in the context of the United States, early history, that is true. I think there are probably some very good arguments that it's not, but I think they ultimately fall apart because if we look at history, when the South does eventually secede, you look at that and you say, well, if they seceded at the very beginning, I mean, that would have been even more catastrophic than it was during the Civil War, and we couldn't have fought ourselves this early. Britain probably would have jumped right in and conquered us back.
Okay, so now you interpreted my question as being historical, which I like because I've been kind of pushing you guys in that direction. Because what we're talking about here is a really interesting problem. In logic, what do we call this, Keen?
A paradox.
Yeah, contradiction is, in this particular case, would be the better term. So this is a contradiction. In other words, you are saying one thing and its opposite at the same time. And Aristotle basically helped us to see, he created, as a philosopher, Aristotle was the inventor of logic, the science of logic. And he called one of the most fundamental rule of logic, he called it the law of non-contradiction. He says, so if you think, if you go with premise one and two and you get to conclusion one, and then you add another premise and you get to conclusion two, and you end up with a contradiction, then you have made an error in your thinking, and you have to go back and resolve it by checking your premises. One of them is wrong. So now, in logic, it would seem that the founders ended up in a contradiction. But as Keane was just discussing, what they ended up with was a historical dilemma. The dilemma was, they knew this was a contradiction, but they also knew that it was true. So, I mean, this is, isn't history fascinating? You can end up with a kind of temporal situation, a temporary situation in which you have to accept something that, well, it's imperfect and you don't like it, but you're going to do it with the understanding that you're going to fight to resolve that. Which is exactly what the founders did. So this very first map of ours here has, you know, an indication of that. See, the founders are kind of aligned in these states. Up here, there are 7 free states. And down here, there are 6 slave states. And then by the compromise of 1787, this territory in light blue will be free of slavery. This territory in light pink will have slavery. But so they're hoping that they're going to kind of create a stable arrangement at first, but hopefully contain slavery in here. Okay? And then, well, the next thing that happens is, but again, their intention is to end slavery. But how are they going to do it? Because what's this? Okay, notice how the map changes here. Put on your geographical detection caps. What's the most blatant change that occurs here? What do we call it? From 1789 to 1803, what's it called, Cliff?
Louisiana
Purchase. Okay, now we have a territory in gray without any specific rules. So it's in gray. Then we have this territory in light blue, this territory in pink, that again, they have rules and they're not states yet. Why do we have dark colored entities now? Somebody should be able to guess why we have dark colored entities. Again, here we go. Ready? Dun, 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 dun. Boom. Okay, what happened? Why are there dark-colored entities? Bria?
Because it's for sure that they're having this very stone, written in stone.
Well, yeah, but why is it written in stone? Because they have changed. They're not territories anymore. What are they?
I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. I put you on the spot. Timothy, what are they?
They're new states.
They're new states. Exactly. Notice this territory down here. Right? From here, this is just a territory. And now it's become a state. And not only that, Vermont got carved out of New York. So we've got new states. And this one's free and these ones have slavery. These are still territories. What do we do with this land? All right. Well, let's go see what happens. Here we have the evolution of the United States to, after the Louisiana Purchase, to 1819. Check it out and tell me what you see happening. Detect the changes. Nice maps, Mr. Powell. What happened there? Louisiana Purchase, 1803. United States, 1819. Okay, Alexander, I know you were impressed. What did you see?
Tons more new states.
Okay, that's one thing. How many new free states?
3.
Okay, geography pop quiz. What were they?
I don't know.
Oh, man. Don't know your American geography? King, go ahead.
I think it's Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio.
All right. Slightly out of order. All right. Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, or going westward, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois. Okay, good. So we got 3 new free states by 1819. And who knows my 3 new slave states? Go ahead, Cliff.
Louisiana.
Okay, this one.
Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama.
All right. The football states. All right, so, good. So, 3 new free states, 3 new slave states. And so now notice what's happening here, right? We've got a balance emerging within the American government that's important to talk about here. So before we move on, I want to talk about the balance. Oh, and yeah, Timothy mentions, yeah, Florida is now a territory. In 1819, Florida was purchased from Spain, so it became a territory. Okay, good observation. That was the other thing that we didn't focus on just yet. Okay, but I want to talk about this process of growth within the Republic of adding new free states and slave states. And why I think up to this point, we have still have a republic in America. And the Missouri Compromise is going to be possibly the last point where we can still say that, but we can still say it. Okay, so let's talk about the plan to get rid of slavery that the founders had. It was embedded in this original concept. What were they doing here? What were they hoping to do by taking this territory and marking this off here in particular? And Thomas Jefferson's plan was even more ambitious. It included this in blue. But what were they doing? Timothy?
They were trying to make more free territory than slave territory.
Yeah. So I'm gonna rephrase that. I'm gonna say they were trying to contain slavery. They're trying to make places within the country where it would be off limits. And consequently, with the death of the slave trade, which would be abolished, and with the removal of chances to expand slavery, they're hoping to create conditions where it would die. And you wouldn't have to have a violent confrontation to deal with the issue. So this was, to my mind, this was a really good plan in theory, I guess you could say, but it's difficult to implement. And when we get to the Louisiana Purchase, we see the difficulty starting to get kind of, you know, worse and worse here. We see them trying, we're getting more territory. What are we going to do with it? Now, one reason to add new territory was to add new states. And the premise was this. If you get more and more states opposed to slavery, what can you do within a country where they are united in a federal manner? What would be the big deal about having more and more states that are against slavery? Bria?
And the ones that were with slavery would be voted down.
Aha, exactly. Okay, now we need to, in order to understand how this is going to work and why it eventually failed, we need to understand a really crucial concept when it came to the Constitution and part of what made the United States a republic. And it was that the Constitution was designed to be very difficult to change. It was designed to not be changeable democratically. This is one of the features of a republic, is that it's kind of immune to the changing whims of the populace. And so you don't want, if you have a republic, you don't want 50% plus one of the people at any particular point in time who've got some whim or some error in their thinking to be able to undermine the Constitution. So in the American system, there were a special set of rules that said you can't change the Constitution with a majority. Does anybody know what it would actually take to change the Constitution and make it illegal to have slavery in America? Timothy?
When you have to have, I'm guessing, all of the states agree.
That's a pretty good guess. So that would have to be unanimity. That would be impossible. So yeah, now having unanimity is kind of, in some cases in Europe today, in the European Union, you have to have unanimity, which is just crippling sometimes. So no, there's a situation in between majority and unanimity that is built into the Constitution, a more practical kind of, acknowledgement of the fact the founders knew they didn't know everything. They hadn't made a perfect country, and changes should be possible. It's just they should be difficult. They should be the result of careful deliberation and a real commitment by the whole of, as much of the country as possible to making a good change. So they had a system built in. Bria?
Is it representatives?
Well, yes, but representatives are in majorities and unanimity as well. It was a condition involving representation that had to be reached. So I'll just tell you the name of it. The condition for changing the Constitution is called supermajority. So see how it's kind of an in-between concept? Majority is 50% plus one. Unanimity is 100%. So what do you figure supermajority is? Alexander?
Two-thirds or three-quarters or somewhere around there.
Yeah, good guess. In fact, it involved both of those fractions. So, yeah, somewhere in there, right? Some reasonable place in the middle. And so this is the way that it worked in the American Constitution. In order to make an amendment, like the Bill of Rights, you had to get two-thirds of the states in the Senate to agree. That was the first part of the supermajority concept. Two-thirds of the states voting in the Senate would have to agree, and you would get a change that would be proposed. So even just to get it proposed, you had to get that many. And then you had to take that to the state governments, and they had to ratify it. And in order for it to pass, three-quarters of the state governments have to ratify. So, not impossible, but as you can see, difficult. Right? If you want to change the American Constitution, you got to get two-thirds of the Senate to go for it. And then even if you've managed to do that, you got to shop it to three-quarters of the states and they've got to agree. So it's difficult to change the Constitution. And that's on purpose. Because America is not supposed to be a democracy where 50% plus one, if they happen to change their mind, can change the whole nature of the country. Right? That would be really easily lead to the undermining of rights. So this was the set of rules. Now, can anybody now kind of see why we're going through this progression of maps? Why does all this geography, which some of you guys are rolling your eyes, oh, I hate geography. Why does all this geography matter? If you want to get rid of slavery, you need a supermajority. Continue, Alexander.
Well, because they seem to be adding equal amounts of states in each color, and you need more than an equal amount in blue.
There we go. Okay, good. So what was going on was there was typically a balance. And indeed, by the time of it, by 1820, when these states were added, and we approach 1820, here we go. Oh, wait, no. Oh, yeah. So back to 1819. This is 1819. So we've added these three. We've got Vermont as well. Okay, and so now the situation that's about to arise in 1820 is this. Okay, here we have this region. It's a territory, and it's ready to become a state. We've got this huge Louisiana territory, and we're excited about that because our country is big, and it's going to be prosperous and everything. And so what's up, Timothy?
I think I might remember this. I think, wasn't this the state that they fought this big bloody war?
No, not yet. No, that's coming later. Not yet. We're not at bloody wars yet. So, the problem with this state was something else. Cliff?
Oh, the problem with the state? I was just going to say the name of the state.
What is the name?
Missouri.
Okay. The problem with the state was it wanted to join as a slave state. Okay, so, and notice where it is geographically. So, we kind of got this line here going down, and we're containing slavery, and maybe we're going to make a cordon around it, right? We're going to stop it. Okay, but now if slavery goes up here, now what? Look at this big Louisiana territory. And who's moving in here? Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri. What happens over here? Who's kind of got dibs? Kind of, I'm being silly here, right? But who's got dibs, Timothy?
All the slave states.
Yeah, there's an unfortunate trend here, potentially, that slavery starts to proliferate within the Louisiana territory. So this now, the founders, because we're still in 1820, we still got founders. We still got James Monroe as the president here. He's going to issue the Monroe Doctrine in a few years. So we're still in the founding era. And we still have this, you know, concern for maintaining independence, but also, you know, trying to promote rights and trying to resolve this dilemma with slavery inside the country. So what do we do? So here's part one of what is called the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Watch carefully as my magic act continues. Part one of the Missouri Compromise. What happened? I know, easy question, right? Oh, Mr. Powell, it's obvious. Timothy, what happened?
Missouri became a slave state and Maine broke off from Massachusetts.
There we go. All right, so in order to maintain at least a balance within the Senate, there were going to be, at this point, 12 and 12, if you count them. In order to maintain a balance, in order to accept the joining of Missouri into the Union, there was an insistence that it needed to be balanced, and therefore Maine was going to be allowed to be its own state. Okay, but that by itself, that's not Republican anymore. You know, that's still Democratic. That's just still, we got 50-50. We're not exactly championing rights here. When are we going to get the Republican element here? Because Mr. Powell said we still have a republic, so why did he say that? Okay, we still have a commitment to changing the world for the better and defending rights. So in what way does the Missouri Compromise still embody that concept? Well, part two of the Missouri Compromise was as follows. Part two of the Missouri Compromise. So what did they do? What did they do? They said, okay, Missouri, you're in. But Maine is a new state. And what else? Alexander?
This huge big chunk of land is all blue and only a little bit of chunk of land is red.
Yeah. So they drew a line. This is the 36th parallel plus 30 seconds. So it's 36 degrees and 30 minutes. There's a line right here in the globe, if you look at it. The bottom of Missouri lined up with it. And so they said, all right, we're going to draw this line across the Louisiana Purchase. And everything to the north is off limits to slavery. Slavery, you only get this. So it was a compromise, but you can see that it was truly a historical compromise that says, we're serious, okay? We mean this. We don't like slavery. We want to get rid of it. It's not part of us. It's a remnant of an older way of life. We want to get rid of it. We want to really be a republic. So we're going to try to fence it in. We're going to do our best to peacefully contain it. So this is the Missouri Compromise of 1820. Hopefully, we can keep it down here. Okay, we haven't been able to stop it yet, but we're going to keep it down here. And look at all this area here. We're going to make free states in here. And pretty soon, we're heading towards a supermajority. So we're moving in the right, this is a compromise that moves us in the right direction. Instead of a compromise that just keeps on proliferating slavery, we've had too many of those. We tried it, it didn't work. But this one could be now the beginning of our solution. All right, so this is the key where we're going to leave off, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, a very serious attempt to extend the principle of anti-slavery in a greater portion of the country and start slowly allowing people to get adapted to it, allow the culture to change, do it in a peaceable manner, slowly create conditions whereby the abolition of slavery would be possible in a civilized manner. Again, the theory. The theory was definitely, you know, worthy of consideration. However, I give you a quote from Thomas Cobb, a Georgia congressman following the Missouri Compromise. He said, as a warning, because he could see this. He didn't, you know, the people who were true Republicans were happy. This was an accomplishment. People who were dedicated to slavery were threatened by this. And so this Thomas Cobb, Georgia congressman, said the following: if you persist, the Union will be dissolved. You have kindled a fire which all the waters of the ocean cannot put out, which seas of blood can only extinguish. Grim warning. And sadly, it proved to be true. This hope for a civilized solution to the problem of slavery was forlorn. It was not to be. So we'll continue to trace this when we come back from spring break. Tomorrow is History Through Art, and then we have spring break. And we'll continue to build on this as we add more and more parts to the country, and we will see that, unfortunately, this plan to limit slavery did not hold. It broke apart in different ways. The next generations of leaders after the Founding Fathers were not as capable of leading the country. We're not as dedicated to rights. And we start to get this slow drift from a true republic. A republic that's flawed and that has this terrible thing that it needs to resolve. It has slavery, but it's a republic. And we start to get a drift from this form of government towards democracy. So we'll follow that story when we get back. All right. Final impressions today? Final thoughts? All right, then. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.